Welcome to Oncology Today. Recent advances in the treatment of Philadelphia chromosome-positive acute lymphoblastic leukemia. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Elias Jabbour from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. In addition to this interview, there is also a video recording featuring Dr. Jabbour's full-length slide presentation. To begin, he provided a macro perspective on the long-term evolution of the management of ALL.
I think in ALL, the major discoveries were the immunotherapy, blinatumomab and inotuzumab and CAR T cells, and a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. These are the major discovery in ALL today. And where the use was reserved for relapse refractory setting in 2024, they're finding their way to the front line. And by doing so, we're improving on the responses, we're deepening the responses, and we're avoiding the need for intensive chemotherapy, long chemotherapy, and transplantation. So historically, in ALL, our treatment, we rely on multiple components. One is induction chemotherapy, which we know. Second is a consolidation, which will take us 6 months. And then, and that can include transplantation. Third is a maintenance program. And fourth is CNS prophylaxis. And that is 3 years of therapy. Today, with our frontline use, we're able to shorten this from 3.5 years to 1.5 years or even less. So these novel drugs are allowing you to deepen the responses and minimize the use of chemotherapy and complications and improve the outcome. And we know as well that using these drugs in a minimal disease setting, like a blinatumomab, is by far better than waiting for the relapse. When it comes to cost effectiveness as well, using these drugs upfront will prevent relapses, shorten chemotherapy, and improve the quality of life and the cost of medicine.
I can kind of remember, I think, a number of times talking to your chairman, Dr. Kantarjian, about blinatumomab when it was first coming out. And actually, when you look at oncology, I mean, I guess that was really the first CD3 bispecific.
Correct.
And now, you know, myeloma, lymphoma.
They all have bispecifics.
But CD3, and also now, there. I don't know if you know, there's a CD3 bispecific that looks very promising in small cell of the lung. So maybe
Correct.
It's even going to come into solid tumors. Can you talk about sort of blinatumomab itself in terms of how it works, what it's like to give it? Because again, they had this long IV infusion. You mentioned the possibility of a sub-Q. But what the reality of what happens and about this drug. And, you know, now we talk about CRS all the time, and I'm curious kind of what kind of CRS platform we see
Correct.
There.
So blinatumomab is a bispecific engager, which is CD3 and CD19. So it's an antibody that can bind to the CD19 on the B cell, CD3 of the T cell, activate the T cell to kill the B cells. That has been already reported and known. Now, that being said, the question is, if we give this drug, what is the price of adverse events we can encounter? What we've seen so far, people were concerned, number one, the short half-life of the drug, therefore we should give continuous infusion. Number one. Number two is the complications can be encountered. You're activating the T cell. We have a cytokine storm that can cause complication and patient may drop the use of the drug. What we've learned, how we can optimize the use of the drugs. What we've learned that we do not need to give the drug in high tumor burden. In fact, with the studies done, first studies done with the blinatumomab, we had to try to reduce the tumor burden before we give the blinatumomab. And by doing so, by reducing the blast percentage up front, we're able to deliver a safe drug where we do not see what we call cytokine release syndrome. We know that this adverse event is dependent on the amount of tumor, and that is true as well for the CAR T cells. But if you give these drugs with a high tumor burden, you're going to have a reaction with the cytokine release syndrome, which is by the definition, fever, chills, hypotension, eventual ICU and vasopressors, and sometimes tocilizumab or other fancy drugs. In our hands today, when we use the blinatumomab, we do induction and we try to reduce the tumor to almost a CR or minimal disease. And you give a blinatumomab sequentially, you don't have the complications encountered. And that is true as well for the CAR T cells. Not only it's safer. We know the drug is more effective when you have minimal disease. And same for the CAR-Ts. So if I have an investment to use these drugs I have better cytoreduce before I give my treatment with oblanatumumab. Now, if you look at the trials done, this MRD trial and the relapse trial and the frontline trial, the efficacy of oblina and the safety is best upfront in no disease setting compared to MRD, compared to full disease burden.
So it's always challenging to bring up other tumors because, of course, it's very different, but I can't help doing that because as general oncologists, you know, we're going to do another webinar next week and it's going to be on lymphoma. And I guess one of the things I think people would think about is, are these, you know, agents really fundamentally different, for example, the CD3 bispecific lymphoma, then, and obviously it's a different situation, but when right now they are giving it to patients who have gross disease. And, you know, I wonder whether or not, you know, they're not using continuous infusions. You know, again, just sort of broadly comparing, you know, the way that the strategy is in these two situations, do you think that it's fundamentally a different drug or just kind of the way it's been developed has been different?
I think when it comes to bispecific, we must cytoreduce the tumor. Whether it's a lymphoma or ALL or others, we must cytoreduce the tumor burden before we pursue our treatment.
That's interesting because, like I said, I mean, I don't know that they always have that opportunity, but here clearly you do because you're starting out in first-line therapy. So for practical purposes right now, when you have a patient with a Philadelphia-positive ALL presenting, we can get into your cases in a second, but just maybe you can talk a little bit about how you, when you know you're going to see a new patient. And incidentally, I mean, when we did this webinar with Courtney and Novel, we were talking about, they were telling me that you all have a new patient conference where you present like 35 or 40 patients a week.
Correct.
I mean,
every Thursday. Correct. We review all new patients.
Hard to believe. But anyhow, what are some of the things that are going through your mind as you sort of think about a patient that you're going to evaluate, for example, older comorbidities versus younger, healthy, some of the disease characteristics? How do you think through?
So usually when I get a patient referred to me, they know more or less what they have outside, whether they have AML or ALL. Let's say they're coming with ALL because we're discussing ALL today. It's really important to have an immune phenotype. It's ALL or no AML. And then if it's in ALL, what features we have? What bad features we have? Is it, first of all, CD20 positive, CD22 positive, CD19 positive? We need to know them upfront. Then we need to look at the karyotype of these patients. We look at the mapping of these patients. Do they have ECAR station plus? Do they have low hypodiploidy? Do they have K2A rearranged disease? So it's really important to know whether we're high risk or low risk and whether pH positive or pH negative in order to decide the next treatment strategy. Assuming it's a pH negative ALL, then we look at a pH-like phenotype, because this will be transplant indication upfront or not. If it's T-cell ALL, it's ATP-ALL or non-ATP-ALL because it's transplant indication. And then, of course, the chemotherapy will change. If it's low hypodiploidy, P53 mutated, do we go for transplant, yes or no? So these are about the biology. Then you have the old of the patient. Somebody who's older, we want to work away from chemotherapy, no chemotherapy to be given, or low-dose chemotherapy, and use immunotherapy upfront. Somebody with a pH positive ALL, do we go for chemotherapy and TKI or chemotherapy free, TKI plus oblina? All these are things that we can dissect upfront in order to make our treatment plan. To summarize, when do I go for transplant in ALL? I go for transplant in somebody who is ATP ALL, which is rare, somebody with a KMT2A rearranged disease, and hopefully in the future we can target them by menin inhibitors. Somebody who had a pH-like ALL, but not all, mainly subset of JAK2 CRF2 positive disease. Somebody with a low hypodiploidy and complex karyotype, in particular, have a P53 mutation. These are the way I go for transplant. If somebody was MRD positive, used to be for transplant indication, today I won't anymore if they respond to blinatumomab. Somebody with a pH positive ALL, where used to be transplant indication in the past, today I won't, especially if they respond with the ponatinib, for example. Relapse setting, I still go for transplant, although we can dissect it. This is when I go for transplant. Now, what do I do? T-cell ALL, I use the hyper-C-VAD backbone. Asparaginase has a place. Nelabine has a place up front. Somebody young, B-cell ALL up front, our regimen today is with hyper-C-VAD. but we shorten from 8 courses to 4 and do blinatumomab, inotuzumab as a consolidation and maintenance of a year and a half, not 3 years anymore, with POMP and the blinatumomab. Older patients with ALL, Philadelphia negative, I use what we call the dose-dense mini-CVD inoblina. I use inoblina up front, and I shorten the chemotherapy for these patients. In a pH-positive ALL, I do blina, and I do essentially blina and ponatinib. And so far, we've seen a great outcome at 4 years, 90% survival.
So let me ask you about a scenario, which I think maybe is going to be coming in the next couple of years, okay. But theoretically, maybe we could do it right now. And this kind of gets back to my analogy to HMA venetoclax and AML, which is you've done this workup, you've won the patient, and they're Philadelphia positive. You've decided that the best way to go is ponatinib, blinatumomab. And you send the patient back to their general medical oncologist to administer the bulk of the therapy. Are you doing that now? Do you think you're going to be doing it in a couple of years? And what would you say to that oncologist who wants to take a shot at being part of the therapy?
That's a great question. I think, yes, it's coming. People may be concerned the first cycle to be given locally, but assuming they go into remission, because we know adverse event can happen the first cycle, as we know in HMA-VEN with the ramp up. I think down the road, yeah, subsequent therapies can be done at home, and have several patients who I induce at MD Anderson, and they can go back home and they get the treatment done locally at home, 1 week of POMP change every week for 4 weeks every 6 weeks.
So can you talk a little bit more about exactly what would need to be done during that time, and also your vision about how the patient experience, the general oncologist experiences would change if and when the drug were available sub-Q?
Well, that's a great question. Sub-Q blinatumomab, if it will be available, will be given daily for the first week, from week two and onward, 3 times per week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We know adverse events happen the first week. Passing the first week, you're very unlikely to have any adverse events. So assuming the data is solid and it's safe, then somebody can go to the hospital, for example, do the first week in the hospital as a ramp up, and then they can go home and they inject themselves, or they come to the office 3 times per week. Now, people may say still 1 week in hospital is too much. Today, we're doing 1 week, but maybe with more data, with more expertise, more experience we generate, we can do it all as an outpatient, but we're not at this stage yet.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your cases. And again, we can sort of think about how a general medical oncologist might be involved in a case like this. Again, I was really struck by the fact that, you know, your talk kind of makes sense and is you can follow it, and it really falls in line with a lot of other, you know, oncologic strategy. I think prior to this, you know, the chemotherapy and the transplant made it a lot more complicated, but
yep.
I'm starting to see, I see a path for the general medical oncologist here.
That's wonderful.
Let's see if that's real. You agree, or what do you think?
I definitely agree. I think things are more and more simplified in the future. I mean, outpatient therapy, shorten the maintenance, that is really a big deal.
Well, again, if you look at, for example, bispecifics in oncology in general, lymphoma and myeloma, they are, a lot of that is being done by community-based oncologists, probably even more in the future.
Correct.
So, you know, this is not the first time they're exposed. You know, they're starting to get their feet wet in terms of cytokine release. Yep. So I think this algorithm that you're talking about seems totally doable in that setting. But let's take a look at some of these cases and see whether or not really that's the case. How about this 48-year-old woman?
This is 48-year-old woman, 1 week of fatigue, fever, nosebleed, in good shape physically. She had no prior medical history, and then her CBC done showed pancytopenias. We have low platelets, low white count. Bone marrow examination showed 90% of blast peroxidase negative, which is what we see in ALL. We did a karyotype on this patient, 922 in all metaphases, and a P19. Typical case of ALL Philadelphia positive, where patient had no prior medical history. They call you, doctor, I have fever, I have chills, I have a bleeding, what do I do? Workup that must be done is the karyotype and the RT-PCR, and they're all positive for Philadelphia positive ALL. The next question we have here, if you have such a patient, she's 48, ALL Philadelphia positive, today in 2024, what do we do? And the options are blina and dasatinib. blinatumomab, dasatinib, prednisone, ponatinib, prednisone, hypercivide regimen with ponatinib or dasatinib. So which plan would go forward? In the USA today, till recently, the most commonly used regimen is the hypercivide and dasatinib for our patients. This is the most commonly used regimen, although dasatinib has no label for frontline ALL. Ponatinib has the only label. Now, in a trial done, in a FALCON trial, the backbone, we do not use it. So in USA, we use more hypercivide or low-dose chemotherapy or mainly prednisone and ponatinib. And recently, based on the data we generated, we moved to TK ponatinib plus blinatumomab or dasatinib plus blinatumomab. So which one to be chosen here? I opt for ponatinib. It's superior to dasatinib. I've been shown that in a propensity score matching. I think if you use ponatinib and prednisone, the rate of response is only 30%, 20% with dasatinib. So ponatinib in any equation is superior to dasatinib. But then adding immunotherapy up front, we're able to improve the outcome to 80% or even higher survival. Therefore, my answer to these options here, I will pick blina and ponatinib up front.
Just to sort of clarify that a little bit, so in what situations would you use chemotherapy?
Not anymore, unless I have somebody with CML in the background.
Interesting.
If you have a CML in the background, you go for chemotherapy. Otherwise, this is the novelties where you have a blina and ponatinib as an option because it shows us that we do not need the chemotherapy anymore.
So what happened with this patient?
Okay, well, with this patient, we elected to give ponatinib blina, and patient went to CR on day 28. We did assess MRD from weekly PCR. By day 14, the level was a 3-log reduction, what we call MMR. No disease. At CMR at day 28, no disease. We assessed for MRD by RT-PCR for BCR-ABL-SYN, NGS for immunoglobulin receptor. Both were negative. So patient responded so well. And the question was, if this patient is responding, do we go for transplant? I often get patients referred to me to ask me the question, doctor, I responded very well. Why I want to wait? Let me move to transplantation. And in fact, we have enough data today showing that if you achieve a CMR merely on ponatinib, transplant doesn't add anything. Therefore, for me, somebody responding should not go for transplant. I may type them for a donor for transplant in the future as an option, but I will not go for transplant. And that will bring me to the question we have in this case. We were asked, what's next? Do I go for transplant? I don't go. The options are listed here. I will go for transplant as soon as possible. No, do not go for transplant. Do blina and ponatinib. C, do transplant only if no response makes sense, or no deletion of the Icarus and other genotype, or switch the dasatinib-based regimen and go for transplant. So the answer is here, since this patient is responding so well by MRD, by NGS and RT-PCR, transplant is not an option to me. I will not switch patient to dasatinib. Patient is doing well on low-dose ponatinib. We should not switch therapy. And she's young female of 48. Therefore, I will maintain this patient on my regimen, which is blina and ponatinib. So I did maintain the patients. Of course, I did not make any change. And this will bring me to the next case. Next question is, the patient completed 5 cycles of therapy, received 12 intratecal chemotherapy. She's on maintenance at 50 milligram ponatinib, which is good because we know such a thing can avoid vascular events. And at 1.5 years of maintenance, the patient remained MRD negative by NGS and RT-PCR. So what's next? Do I go for transplant? No, if you're coaching a basketball team and your team is winning, why you want to change the strategy? You're winning, keep winning. So here, allotransplant is a no because patient is doing very well. Option D is not an option because dasatinib, why you want to switch to dasatinib? We know that ponatinib is superior. I will not do such a thing unless I have a reason, and I have no reason here. Then the question is, do I maintain ponatinib for lifetime? Or maybe consider 5 years of ponatinib, or 5 years of CMR, and multiply by NGS MRD. Short answer today, in what we know today, the right answer is give ponatinib for lifetime. But things are evolving and we're learning. As we did in CML, if we're able to eradicate minimal disease for 5 years and longer, we may be able to stop the TKI and consider treatment discontinuation. We're testing such a thing right now. Option C is being evaluated, but not yet standard of care. Standard of care is option B, but keep an eye on this. Things are changing. In the future, we may be able to stop the treatment and cure the patient completely.
So I was just sort of flashing on a similar program I did about a year ago with one of your MD Anderson colleagues, Dr. Michael Wong, on mantle cell lymphoma. Yeah. And he was telling me about how he was treating mantle cell, and I was all excited because he wasn't using chemo and he's using BTK inhibitors. And then next thing we did a webinar with a couple other lymphoma people, and they're like, whoa, he's like a little far ahead of us. We're not quite there. So this case that you just described, do you think that most, academic or docs at tertiary centers who focus on leukemias, would they generally be using the exact same strategy, or are you a little bit ahead of them?
No, we're ahead of them. Actually, they're still using hyper-CVAD, most of them, and ponatinib. Blina doesn't have a label in a frontline so far. It's NCCN recommendation, but we published our data twice in Lancet and JCO, and it's gaining more and more momentum. I think this is the future. I think 5 years from today, everybody will be using this regimen. It's not yet a regimen used by everybody, but if I'm in a community setting, this is the regimen, it's so easy. It doesn't have sepsis, nor infections, nor come back and forth. I put a port, see them once every week for 4 weeks, and then 6 months, and I'm done. So I think it's really a regimen that can want to change the outcome of patients drastically. Now, the second question is, do you give ponatinib for lifetime? We're ahead of the curve. I think stopping is very innovative, but risky. I don't recommend anybody to stop the TKI before we get more data because it's risky.
Yeah, no, I mean, I came out of that experience with Dr. Wong thinking, if I had mantle cell, I think I'd be going to see him because it kind of makes more sense. But there's always this issue of, how much does it take to change practice?
Correct. And I get patients who will come to see me because they were offered transplant somewhere else and they heard about my trial. And why want to go for transplant if I can skip it? I get patients coming to me because they don't want to lose their hair. They want to go through chemotherapy. They can get this drug for 6 months and they're done. Why not? But unfortunately, this is for only privileged people who can travel to Houston and spend their time and money here.
So one other question just sort of, again, popped into my head, which is, I'm kind of curious, why do you think intrathecal therapy actually works? It seems like kind of a gross, non-targeted strategy, and yet it seems to work. Any thoughts about how does it really work by, directly killing the tumor cells, or what do you think is going on there?
It does. We thought that the TKI can cross the CNS barrier, and it turned to be they do not. In old days, we used to give hyper-CVAD, so we give chemotherapy, cytarabine, methotrexate, and it crossed the barrier, kill all the small cells hidden somewhere. With the TKI, we don't kill them. And then the Blina doesn't cross the barrier. So we're left with a place where these patients, these cells are not getting any therapy. I hate chemotherapy. I would have loved to avoid chemotherapy completely. But unfortunately, we have 7 relapses. 4 of them are CNS. So we must give some TKIs. Now, here, Dr. Love, the future. I show you one slide about the CAR-Ts. And in my presentation, it's only 18 patients. CAR-Ts, unlike blinatumomab, can cross the CNS barrier. You have T-cell activated. So maybe if we do CAR-Ts as a consolidation, we can avoid CNS chemotherapy penetration or others. But that's still investigation, still early on. But one of the problems we face as oncologists, once I have somebody CNS relapse, isolate, what do I do? I do radiation, but maybe CAR-T is the way to go. That's being explored as we speak.
So one more question I want to hear about your other case. I'm curious where your 48-year-old lady is right now, and I assume she's kind of gotten beyond the major part of her therapy. Just kind of curious from her perspective, what do you think this experience has been like? How long did it take for her? Did she ever get back to her normal life? What happened to her during this time?
It's amazing because we're excited about the data. The patients are way happier than we are because they, first of all, something a bit simple and benign. They do not lose their hair. They don't get infection. they get only the first few weeks in the hospital and then all outpatient. Instead of spending 2.5 years getting therapy, they get only 6 to 8 months of treatment and they resume their normal life. In fact, beyond the first cycle, I had patients who go back to their work carrying a pump next to their belt. It's really impressive because compliance is an issue. Dr. Love, you know, in USA, people have a problem with insurance and copay and others. And one of the problems with the ALL treatment is 3 years of treatment. You have a young man or a young woman early on in their life, they can't afford it. They drop the care and they relapse. If you give 6 months of therapy to somebody, mainly as an outpatient, then they're compliant and you can cure them. My patients are resuming a normal life, which is amazing to me and to them.
Incidentally, both of the patients you have here are under the age of 50. How do you see older patients tolerating this regimen?
No difference, similar between older and younger. It happens to have these two patients, they are lead patients who are young, but if somebody who's 80 years old, they get a treatment. The one thing with 80 years old, I would be careful for vascular events, make sure the hypertension is controlled, their statin is on board. This is controlled completely. Two, we've seen more neuro problems with the blinatumomab. Patient can get confused or they get tremor. The handwriting can change. I think we should be vigilant with the blinatumomab in older patients. So just hold the dose, reduce, give steroid. We don't have to push for 5 courses. 2 may be good enough. So the difference between older and younger when it comes to blina, we see more neuro events with the blina. Not grade 5 or grade 4, God forbid. It's only minor things, but can be manageable, and we should keep an eye on that and do not push for the dose of the treatment.
I've heard stories about how the spouse actually picks up the neuro changes, and the patient may not be aware of it. Have you seen that?
Yes, I did in older patients, but highly manageable. Patient, for example, forget they have memory issues, but it's very reversible and very acute. It can be reversed as soon as you stop the drug and you give some steroid.
Interesting. Let's hear about your other case, a 38-year-old man.
A 38-year-old man, same fatigue, same starting. And the question is, this was an older case before we get all the fancy treatment today. The options are hyper-CVAD, dasatinib, prednisone, ponatinib, hyper-CVAD, ponatinib, or hyper-CVAD and dasatinib. Of course, hyper-CVAD alone is not an option. I will not go with the TKI alone because we know the MRD negativity is low. We've shown that hyper-CVAD ponatinib is superior to hyper-CVAD and dasatinib. Therefore, logically speaking, we opted for hyper-CVAD and ponatinib at that time. And we picked this answer, and the patient was induced hyper-CVAD and ponatinib. CR was observed rapidly. This patient was monitored very carefully the first 2-3 weeks to get him to CR because when the complication can arise. Day 21, response confirmed. We did a bone marrow on day 21. MMR was achieved, 3 log reduction. And after 2 courses of treatment, we did achieve a complete molecular remission by RT-PCR, no disease, that was confirmed after 2 additional cycles. Now, here the story, he had a donor identified, match on a donor. And the question is, what to do for this patient? You go for allotransplant and drop and do TKI maintenance. You do hyper-CVAD ponatinib, you maintain the treatment, or you do autologous stem cell transplant since he's MRD negative, one can collect his cells and do transplant. And the answer is autotransplant is a no. Allotransplant in CMR, no benefit. Therefore, since he's responding, we maintain the chemotherapy with the hyper-CVAD and ponatinib. Now, the question of ponatinib comes next is, if somebody is getting ponatinib and responding, what dose do you give? So we decided to pursue hyper-CVAD and ponatinib. We put transplant on hold. And what dose of ponatinib would you use? We start at 45, we reduce to 30. I think it's the key here to reduce the dose of ponatinib to avoid vascular problems. So please, it's very important to adjust the dose. Even though he's young, we've seen adverse events, we've seen vascular events. So therefore, 45, 30, or 15, we have good data showing that 15 is good enough. We therefore adjust the dose and reduce ponatinib to 15 milligrams per day, and we kept it in a continuous fashion. Now, this patient is doing well. He gets his chemotherapy, had 8 intrathecal chemotherapy. The question is, what is the optimal CNS prophylaxis? Nothing further, 8 intrathecal, radiate, go for allotransplant with the hope the transplant can kill anything in the CSF or complete a dose of 12. We used to give 8 intrathecal, and patients living longer and longer, we've seen around 13% having relapse in their CNS. Therefore, we and already we're giving a lot of chemotherapy, we elected to give 12 intrathecal in a very empirical fashion, no science behind it. And we've shown by doing more intrathecal, we had less relapses. So here, if you give CSI, he's 38, you may take a risk here on dementia and other complications down the road. Therefore, I will not do CSI. I will give 12 intrathecal chemotherapy. So we give 12 intrathecal for this patient. And he completed the hyper-CVAD, 8 cycles. He was on maintenance therapy 16 months down the road while he was in CMR. He lost his CMR. HPCR came back positive at 0.6%. No mutation identified in a kinase domain. What do we do? So I highlighted in my talk at the beginning in a Falcon trial where molecular relapses were not censored for event in event-free survival, but in practice, we do act on them. So how do we act on them? The options are, do we go for transplantation? Do we go switch TKI to bosutinib, for example? Do we go back to ponatinib dose of 45 milligrams per day? Or we increase ponatinib and add a blinatumomab? So transplant can be an option, but we know that outcome of transplant is better if you have minimal disease or no disease at all. So if you're going to go for transplant, still go for it, but try to go when somebody had no disease. Bosutinib doesn't work. If you fail ponatinib, forget about bosutinib. It doesn't work at all. You increase ponatinib, that is an option, but Blina had the label for MRD positivity. Therefore, in my committed practice, I want to add a Blina for this patient and push the dose of ponatinib to 30 milligrams. So Blina is the label for MRD positivity, which is the case here. I will add a Blina and do ponatinib at 30 milligrams per day. So we did so, and after we've done such a thing, patient responded so well after one course of Blina and ponatinib and regained CMR, and not only by RT-PCR, now we have NGS available to us at 1 million cells. So patient is responding so well. What to do next? Transplant as soon as possible. Give a second course and proceed with the transplant. Stop therapy and maintain on ponatinib. Complete 4 cycles of Blina, reduce ponatinib to 15 milligrams and maintain. Short answer today, board question here. Transplant is the way to go. You go for transplant rapidly. You wait after second course. Maybe you need if transplant is not ready, but both options are equivalent. Things are changing, however. I think Blina 1 course is not good enough. You can have relapses happening. If you do 4 courses of Blina and you're MRD negative, you may not need a transplant. This patient, 38, refused transplant. He said, do everything you can to avoid transplant. So we did 4 courses of Blina, reduced ponatinib to 15, and we monitor carefully with MRD by NGS. And by doing so, we're able to avoid transplantation. So you can go for transplant. This is not the wrong answer. But if I can avoid transplant, I would. And if I have somebody who's MRD negative by NGS, then I would avoid transplantation. And this patient received 4 Blina, refused transplantation, and CMR maintained 3 years post Blina and ponatinib.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Jabbour, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.